Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 10, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Congressional debate on Iraq draws to a close and the House votes in favor of giving the president authority to use force in Iraq.
The ayes are 296, the nays are 133, the joint resolution is passed.
In Oakland, dock workers are forced back to work. And Sri Lankan mothers of the missing make bridges towards peace. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, at least three people died in Pakistan's first general election since a military coup ended democratic rule in 1999. The intimidation, especially by the military, was overwhelming at polling places throughout the country, as reported to the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan's national director, Hussein Naqi.
Even in city like Karachi, the rangers did not allow entry to scores of people to enter and cast their votes.
Self-proclaimed President General Pervez Musharraf said in a national address that he was pleased with the outcome of the day's elections, especially with all the new faces he had hoped for after limiting Parliament's authority over the summer. Mr. Naqi, however, said he's surprised by U.S. support for Musharraf's version of democracy.
This is very strange that a country which professes democracy and which preaches democratic values should be supporting military usurpers. This is very strange, isn't it?
The International Court of Justice in The Hague has thwarted U.S.-backed Nigerian claims to an oil-rich peninsula off the coast of Guinea, instead choosing French-supported Cameroon and raising tensions in the region. Sam Olukoya has more from Lagos.
The disputed peninsula is known as Bakassi. It has a large reserve of crude oil, and it is in the Gulf of Guinea, off the coast of West Africa. The court's ruling, which is in favor of Cameroon, has dashed American hope that concession to exploit the huge oil reserve will go to American companies like Chevron Texaco and ExxonMobil. Nigeria and Cameroon have thousands of troops on the Bakassi Peninsula, and both countries have clashed several times in the area. Observers fear the court verdict will not end the dispute, but rather heighten tension between both countries. There had been persistent reports that the United States plans to establish a military base in the area, but American officials have denied this report. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Harvard University bailed out Harkin Energy when George W. Bush was on the board of directors, using a questionable off-the-books partnership, according to a report by Harvard Watch. Thatcher Collins reports from Cambridge.
In 1986, several months after Harvard Business School graduate George W. Bush joined Harkin Energy through a merger, Harvard University's endowment bought nearly a third of the company to become its largest shareholder. In 1990, 2 months after Bush and the board learned that Harkin faced bankruptcy, Bush sold his Harkin shares, realizing over $800,000 in profit. Later, after reporting millions of dollars in losses, Harkin's stock plummeted. Then Harkin and Harvard created a partnership, transferring $36 million in debt from Harkin to the new company. Harkin's stock took off, and Harvard then sold much of its stock, realizing millions in profit, after which the stock fell again. Bush and Harvard officials deny insider trading and deny doing anything illegal. The partnership exploited a legal accounting loophole that hides debt from the public, a loophole also exploited by Enron. Thatcher Collins in Cambridge for Free Speech Radio News.
A newly disclosed FBI memo has brought to light abuses of surveillance powers granted to the FBI by a secret intelligence court, which possesses the power to grant warrants to federal agents in terrorism and espionage cases. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
Earlier this year, the court of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act refused to grant the Justice Department greater powers in seeking special warrants and publicly chastised the FBI, accusing the Bureau of misrepresenting the facts in over 75 cases. Now a new internal FBI memo details widespread abuses from illegally videotaping suspects to intercepting emails without court permission. George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley points out that information regarding such abuses, including the memo that was first uncovered yesterday, should have been part of the public debate over the USA Patriot Act.
Many of us raised concerns about the use of FISA and its abuses, and the government brought forth former NSA general counsels and other people who insisted that FISA has never been abused, there's no evidence of abuse, when they knew all along that there were, in fact, these memos and these issues of such abuse.
FBI officials claim that these mistakes have since been corrected. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraq today again invited the United States to inspect sites the White House says are used to house weapons of mass destruction. The White House says inspections should only proceed after the UN passes a new resolution with tough conditions on the Iraqis. Iraq accuses the U.S. of seeking a pretext for war and threatens to teach the U.S. a, quote, unforgettable lesson if the U.S. pursues its stated goal of regime change in Iraq. Meanwhile, in Washington, the House of Representatives voted to authorize the president to use force against Iraq.
The ayes are 296, the nays are 133, the joint resolution is passed.
The Senate is expected to follow suit. Josh Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
The president's resolution passed the House 296 to 133, authorizing the use of force in Iraq. Democratic House Leader Richard Gephardt welcomed the measure.
To our enemies who watch this Democratic debate and wonder if America speaks with one voice, I say have no doubt. We are united as a people in defending ourselves.
The House handily defeated amendments by California's Barbara Lee and Michigan's John Spratt to weaken the resolution, but not without a fight from a vocal House minority. On the House floor, Democrat Jerry Nadler of New York noted a warning from CIA Director George Tenet this week that Saddam Hussein might be more of a threat if attacked than if left alone.
It's one thing to say to Saddam Hussein, we are going to disarm you of your weapons of mass destruction. It's another thing to say, we are going to kill you, which is what regime change means. Faced with that threat, why shouldn't he go down in history as an Arab hero by attacking Israel with chemical or biological weapons?
The version of the president's Iraq resolution agreed to by the Senate leadership encourages the president to take all diplomatic means first, and it requires he report to Congress every 60 days if an attack takes place. But across town, a coalition of peace groups worried about the fate of Iraq in the aftermath. Iraqi-American businessman Anas Shalal says the White House is poised to install a puppet leader favorable to U.S. interests.
For change to take hold in Iraq, it would have to come and take place from within. There is no shortage of Iraqi opposition groups. The INC is the group of choice for the U.S. and the CIA. This group is now headed by Sharif Ali, who is the nephew of the late king. Its previous head and de facto leader is Ahmed Chalabi. I'm sure you've heard of him. He was convicted of embezzlement and 31 felony charges in Jordan. Senator Lieberman called Mr. Chalabi a principled man. In the words of one Iraqi, we do not want to be Karzai'd.
Anti-war demonstrations continue at congressional offices in several states. Protesters were removed from the House floor today for the second day in a row. Capitol Police say they arrested 13 people last night after a protest that featured Kevin Martin of a group called Peace Action.
I did a little research on the web today on opensecrets.com, and I'm thinking, well, maybe some of these people that are going to vote for the war are getting a lot of money from the weapons contractors, from the merchants of death. You think maybe that has something to do with it? Joe Lieberman, United Technologies, $36,000. Dick Gephardt, Boeing, $17,400. Trent Lott, Northrop Grumman, $20,000. Evan Bayh, Carlyle Group, $26,000. Max Cleland, Lockheed Martin, $30,000. Maria Cantwell, Boeing, $9,300. Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, who just came out today in favor of the war. From Northrop Grumman, $15,500. From Lockheed Martin, $14,400.
According to the British magazine The Economist, in recent weeks, Iraq has signed contracts with French, Italian, and Spanish oil giants in an effort to make European Security Council members think twice before supporting a U.S. invasion. President Bush says he'll continue to pursue diplomatic means of disarming and dethroning Saddam Hussein. But with the resolution that could pass the Senate tonight, Congress is telling the White House the U.N. is not an obstacle. With the help of Dora Ruse on Capitol Hill, I'm Josh Chaffin for Free Speech Radio News.
Argentinians took to the streets again this week, this time to protest the threat of a U.S. war on Iraq. The demonstration was organized by the Federation of University Students from Buenos Aires, together with organizations of unemployed workers, popular assemblies, and left parties. Pablo Moreno explains why so many Argentinians oppose the possibility of U.S. military action against Iraq.
In Buenos Aires, 2,000 people marched to the North American embassy, denouncing the United States' push to invade Iraq. Here in Argentina, demonstrations held over the past few days echo those organized in other parts of Europe and the United States. Andres, 25 years old, a member of Popular Assembly, give us their opinion on these new demonstrations.
Bueno, se convirtieron así por motus propio en los sheriffs del mundo y se meten en donde se les da la gana.
I support the marches that are being organized in Europe and the United States. The government from the United States has become the sheriff of all countries, and they invade places where they can gain the most. At the moment, there is a connection between all these demonstrations. There is a connection between the struggles in Latin America and the Middle East, because neither of the two people like the sheriff. For that reason, today, we are saying they should leave.
Apart from rejecting the politics of war spearheaded by the United States, the demonstration denounced the International Monetary Fund and the International Financial Organism. The population in Argentina strongly reject the American government's pressure to force the Argentinian government to pay the interest of the foreign debt from the nation's reserve in the Central Bank of Argentina, a precedent in financial history. At the moment, the Argentinian government continues to work on an agreement with the International Monetary Fund for not falling in a default, as the value of the Argentinian peso continues to devalue in the face of the dollar, and the prices of basic products of subsistence for the population continue to increase, worsening the crisis in the impoverished sectors in the society. The growing poverty and the potential for war in Iraq, Argentinians say, many in their society empathize with the others suffering daily in the countries of the Third World. Moises, 35 years old, a member of the Territorial Movement of Liberation, an organization of unemployed workers, picketeers, says on the situation.
Están dominando hace mucho a todo el mundo, y lógico que, una vez más te repito, el pueblo por fin despertó o está despertando.
The North American government and the IMF have been dominating everybody for a long time. And just recently, people have awakened, and now we respond to all these aggressions that we are receiving. For that reason, I believe that it is very positive that the total population, including a majority of the poor people, are coming out in favor of protesting against the attacks from the United States on Iraq, against Yankee imperialism. The people are organizing so that the attacks stop, the attacks that are not only against the people of Iraq, but against the people of Latin America and other countries of the world.
The demonstration concluded violently when a small number of protesters threw some stones against the fences encircling the North American embassy. In response, the federal police dispersed the crowd with tear gas. Many Argentinians believe, without many other alternatives, the Argentinian government confronts an uncertain future in the face of popular unrest and public mobilizations urging economic and social political change. Argentinians are pushing for non-payment of the foreign debt. A major demonstration is scheduled to take place October 30, the Treaty of Free Trade of the America, ALCA, and for an alternative policy to the one imposed from the North American government with the help of the International Financial Organism. For Free Speech Radio News, in Buenos Aires, we are Pablo Moreno and Pablo Boido.
Last night, longshoremen returned to work at the West Coast ports after President Bush enacted the rarely used Taft-Hartley Act. The Pacific Maritime Association, or PMA, requested 431 workers, but the International Longshore and Warehouse Union produced only 180 workers. This morning, labour activists chained themselves in front of the PMA offices and hung signs that said it was the PMA who locked the workers out. Mitch Jeserich reports from the Oakland port.
As a San Francisco bay crowded with barges full of crates, Oakland port workers, who have been locked out for 11 days, returned to work on Wednesday at the orders of President George Bush, who enacted an 80-day cooling-off period. But the Port Workers Union, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, says the president's move was to aid the port owners. Lawrence Thibault is a port worker and a member of the ILWU.
We understand what's going on. All of the shippers want the free flow of global cargo to come and go without any interference. And as a labor union, we're in that way of that. And they want to get us out of the way. So in the big picture, that's what this is all about. They want to put us in a position where we are not able to have a collective bargaining agreement with good terms and conditions and employment.
The Pacific Maritime Association, or PMA, requested for 431 workers, but the union came up with only 180 people to work last night. The union said that they normally dispatch 120 workers a day and that it would be tough to meet the PMA's demand. The labor dispute is primarily over technology and safety. The PMA wants to bring in new computers and machines to run the ports. The ILWU wants a guarantee that the port's current workers are the ones who operate the new technology, but port owners won't go for it. The union is also alarmed that five longshoremen have died in the last 6 months while on the job. Lee, who has worked for the Oakland ports for over 30 years, says he can't imagine that the 80-day cooling-off period will result in a labor agreement.
I don't see it because we've been working now since July without a contract, and they've been negotiating since then. And then things break down. Hey, they go into a session, and it's always one thing or another. One of the other parties leave the discussion. So, but by the government coming in, I think that just it puts a little more fuel behind PMA, but also it sort of angers us too. Because of the way this lockout was.
When the 80 days are over, if the two sides have not reached an agreement, they can continue with either a lockout or a strike. Only an act of Congress could then force the workers back. PMA's president and CEO, Joseph Mineacci, said in a written statement that the Taft-Hartley Act will help the two sides come to an agreement because it will require that they use a federal mediator. President Bush said he invoked the Taft-Hartley decision because a lockout was costing the nation between $1 and $2 billion a day. However, Larry Karp, professor of agricultural and resource economics at UC Berkeley, questions the numbers related to the effects of the lockout on the economy because they have been produced by an analysis company contracted by the PMA.
The kinds of estimates of damages that we've been hearing are conjectural. And as far as I'm aware, they have been produced by one side of the debate. I'm not suggesting that that they've rigged the numbers. I don't mean that at all. I just mean that I think that these numbers have been produced by one side of the debate.
This morning, eight activists from the People's Action for Labor Solidarity were arrested after chaining themselves to the door of the PMA's San Francisco office. They say they want to set the record straight that it was the dock owners who locked the workers out, not a strike by the union. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezrich in Oakland.
In a country torn up by a bloody 19-year-old war, a group of Sri Lankan women, mothers of missing soldiers, travelled into former bitter enemy territory determined to keep the fragile ceasefire. Jonaki Lafis spoke with some of these women.
Sri Lanka negotiated a fragile peace agreement between the Sinhalese government majority and the Minority Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam last February. The Tamil Tigers, or the LTTE, most of whom are Hindus, have fought for an independent state in the north and the east of the island. The government forces in the south, mostly Buddhist, have been the dominant rulers. The conflict has claimed over 60,000 lives and paralyzed the island for nearly 20 years. It has not really been an ethnic conflict, according to Janine Guthrie, longtime researcher on Sri Lanka for Human Rights Watch.
I hesitate ever to just call it an ethnic conflict. It's much more complicated than that. It's a extremely politically manipulated ethnic conflict in that various political actors have used ethnic differences and rivalries to pursue very political goals.
A group of 100 Sinhalese women from Colombo in the south, mothers of missing soldiers, who are anxious that the war not reignite, started a process of trust building with their former enemies. They made an historic trip in September to the north to meet with the mothers of the disappeared in Jaffna. Vishakha Dharmadasa from the Association of War-Affected Women in Colombo talks about the need for the solidarity of the women.
It was very necessary that the mothers got together and strengthened the peace process because it's so fragile. Anything, like, you know, any extremist, any outsider could sort of give a little flame into these mothers of either side. Because, a child is missing. It's a very painful situation. And for that reason, we wanted for each other to have the strength, to have their shoulders, without getting sort of carried away by a third party just telling something who wants the war.
The Prime Minister of Sri Lanka handed over a list of detainees in prisons, but the Tamil mothers from Jaffna claim that there is not a single name of their children who disappeared in 1996 to 97 on that list. The story is the same in the south. Janine Guthrie of Human Rights Watch says that there are at least 1,000 detainees being held by both sides.
There certainly are prisoners of war. There are, on the government side, quite a few Tamil detainees that have been picked up under various security regulations who may or may not be considered prisoners of war. There are also the servicemen who have been arrested by the LTTE.
Vishakha Dharmadasa says that it is likely that most of the missing persons are dead. The families have no bodies to identify. Kauri Velsalmi from Jaffna, mother of missing Tamil tigers, has not given up hope.
He gave us a list of children who are to be released soon, but in that list, our children's names are not included.
Our children are living. We want them as soon as possible.
The group of mothers visited religious places from each other's traditions. This was an unprecedented action by a civil society group in Sri Lanka. Again, Kauri Valsalmi.
We prayed, all of us prayed, for our children to come as soon as possible.
The mothers who attended the weekend will act as peace ambassadors when they return to their villages, sharing their understanding of the common sorrows with women from both the Tamils and the Sinhalese. Vishakha Dharmadasa describes their shared understanding.
Last evening when we were parting, you know, the mothers from Jaffna, they came, they embraced me, they were embracing each other. It was really nice to see, because though all of them are undergoing and was undergoing a terrible pain due to, you know, their sons being missing and husbands being missing, but they were together, they were laughing, and they were showing a closeness. So that was really, really nice.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Janaki Lafis.
Evidence has been mounting for some time that international peacekeepers deployed in crisis zones become involved with local mafia dealing in sex slavery and trafficking in women, many of them underage. Sexual trafficking has assumed frightening proportions in the Balkans, which is both a transit and destination point for trafficked women, the majority from poor Eastern European countries. The allegations of international involvement in sexual trafficking have now triggered calls for stricter controls for peacekeepers deployed in conflict zones. Sputnik Kalambe reports.
It's almost as if they don't really understand the big picture of what I did have to give up to do this, and the fact that most corporations and most international organizations don't want a person like me who's willing to speak out and tell the truth.
Katrin Bolkovats, a former U.S. police officer fired last year for speaking out on the involvement of internationals in the sex trade when serving in the multinational police task force in Bosnia between 1999 and 2001. Bolkovats has now won a wrongful dismissal case against her former employer DynCorp, an Anglo-U.S. private company that recruits peacekeepers on behalf of the U.S. government. A settlement with DynCorp is expected this autumn, but fighting the company has depleted the savings of this mother of three, who now works with a courier company in the Netherlands.
They're willing to say you did a great job and keep up the good job and good work, but on the other hand, I don't have a lot of people offering me a job. So it's very mixed feelings, and I would do it all again. There's no doubt in my mind that I would.
Katrin Bolkovats was a key speaker at a recent conference on human rights and democracy organized by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, in the Polish capital, Warsaw. Estimates suggest more than 700,000 people, especially women and girls, are trafficked across the borders worldwide. Almost one-third of this figure concerns the Balkans, which has become a major transit and destination point. And one reason for this clearly is the huge international presence in the region.
The majority of the people exploiting the women are organized criminals, and that's the majority of the money coming in to support that definitely comes from international sources, not from locals. In Bosnia, it was at least 10% international involvement, at least 10%. And that's only what was being reported. Locals visit the brothels, and locals are involved in the transport of these women once they're in the country and setting up the bars. But, you know, that's... They wouldn't be doing that if the internationals weren't there.
The OSCE is clearly concerned about the mounting evidence that international peacekeepers have become party to the very crimes they're supposed to combat. Jyoti Kanik, OSCE advisor on anti-trafficking issues, on the line from Warsaw.
Where you have a very large international field presence, you have an injection into the economy, so it's not necessarily only internationals who would be involved with this kind of criminal activity, but there's an injection in the economy, and obviously... and this potential for demand for the sex industry and other areas which would bring in trafficking is definitely a concern. The OSCE has taken measures both regionally but also in specific field missions in Kosovo and Bosnia to raise awareness about the problem but also to set clear standards for personal conduct and disciplinary measures that may follow. But again, from what we've seen, these disciplinary measures often would just at the most result in someone being suspended and sent home. And this is not a strong enough response for the allegations that they are facing.
One of Bolkovac's former bosses at DynCorp is a case in point. Despite being a regular brothel visitor, he was not fired, though, adds Bolkovac, he was made to sign a form that he would never work for the UN again. Leaving the hiring of peacekeepers in crisis zones to private companies is another major problem, she says. Since the U.S. doesn't have a national police force or mechanism for sending police forces overseas, it contracts a private company to recruit the necessary personnel. There's also a financial angle to all of this. The U.S. State Department pays up to $350,000 per officer recruited, of which only $45,000 actually ends up in the officer's pocket. The only thing they get, adds Bolkovac, is a uniform and a ticket in and out of the country.
If it's not stopped, there has to be a mechanism for at least making more accountability to this private contractor. For instance, what happened to me, I've had one individual in our government thank me for what I did. That was my congressman in Nebraska. But even after I've won my lawsuit and there's been all this publicity, not one single U.S. representative has come to me and said, you know, we're sorry this happened to you. We're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. And it's just as if they want to be removed from the whole situation. DynCorp is a buffer for them.
Bolkovac says that to date, no international official has contacted her about her findings in Bosnia. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the dust seems to have settled after the initial furor sparked when she decided to sue DynCorp.
I get the impression that the media and the press even is reluctant to report what's really going on. The thing that bothered me the most was the fact that they were always relating the headlines to the UN and prostitution. And the fact that a private corporation, DynCorp, had done this to me was really secondary. You know, that was the main issue. I didn't sue the UN. I sued a private corporation that was hired by our government.
Catherine Bolkovac could be bitter, but she's not. In fact, she has high praise for the majority of police officers she worked with. Perhaps one positive outcome is that her voice is now being heard, and by the powers that be. And a great deal more pressure is needed to ensure that, at the very least, peacekeepers do not continue to be a part of the problem. Sputnik Kilambi for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Deepa Fernandez.